You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. A Seaside City Councilor's recall seems likely. Preliminary results for Tuesday's recall election of Ward 3 City Councilor Seamus McVay show more than 170 people voting in favor of recalling him, with 140 people opposed. Clatsop County Clerk Tracy Cravanco says some ballots have been challenged and more are still coming in via mail. The challenged ballots include ballots that are not signed or ones where the signatures do not match what the county has on file. Cravanco says those votes should be cured over the next 7 to 14 days. April 7th is the last day to resolve the ballot challenges, and April 13th is the last day to certify the election. If the results hold, McVay will step down from city council once the election is certified. He was elected in 2024 with the term set to expire at the end of 2028. The petitioners behind the recall claimed McVay was elected under false pretenses and had been secretive about his past criminal record and a name change. Supporters, meanwhile, said all of this information had been publicly available and described the recall push as a vendetta. McVay has denied the allegations against him. He declined to comment on the recall election results. Lincoln County employees have been directed to not attend in-person Board of Commissioners meetings due to safety concerns. KLCC's Brian Bayhuth reports.
According to Lincoln County Commissioner Walter Chuck, county employees received an email last Friday from the county's Human Resources Director that instructs them to attend county commission meetings remotely due to safety concerns and liability exposure. The letter says disruptive members of the public have gotten out of control during public comment and staff fear for their safety. County Council Kristen Yule spoke during Wednesday's Board of Commissioners meeting.
So I've been directed by Human Resources from our insurance company that as an employee, I'm not allowed to attend an in-person business meeting right now.
Yule added that public comment will be allowed when legally mandated on matters such as land use issues, but otherwise, Board of Commissioners meetings will be held virtually and public comment during meetings is suspended. I'm Brian Bayhuth reporting.
Institutions across Oregon are reckoning with sexual abuse allegations against the civil rights icon Cesar Chavez. OPB's Bryce Dole reports.
For decades, Chavez was hailed as a pivotal figure in the fight for better pay and treatment of farm workers. In Oregon, at least one street, three schools, and a university cultural center bear his name. But a New York Times report says he sexually abused women and girls. That includes Dolores Huerta, who helped him found the United Farm Workers Union. The allegations shocked local leaders like Representative Ricky Ruiz, a Democrat from Gresham. Raised by farm workers, he said Chavez inspired his political work.
I truly do believe as like we cannot pick and choose where we stand with survivors. Like accountability should never depend on, you know, the power of someone or the status of someone.
School districts in the Willamette Valley say they're discussing whether to remove Chavez's name. A Portland city councilor also said on Wednesday that she wants to change the name of Cesar Chavez Boulevard. I'm Bryce Dole, reporting.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has asked Peace Health to delay its transition away from a local emergency physician group to staff its Lane County emergency rooms. KLCC's Rebecca Hansen-White reports.
Kotek's request for a six-month delay comes after Peace Health announced it would end its decades-long relationship with Eugene Emergency Physicians in favor of Apollo MD, a Georgia-based staffing company. The deal has drawn scrutiny from state lawmakers over concerns it could run afoul of Oregon's restrictions on corporate ownership in medicine. Kotek said she was concerned about the system's ability to transition safely after challenges the community experienced when Peace Health closed its University District Emergency Room in 2023. Kotek said she's closely monitoring state oversight of the agreement and the staffing company's efforts to recruit qualified physicians. I'm Rebecca Hansen-White, reporting.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Federal workers have opened offices across Western Washington to help with ongoing recovery efforts after major flooding in December. They're offering low-interest disaster loans to residents who may be struggling to rebuild. KNKX reporter Mitch Borden has the details.
Tucked away in the corner of a library in Snohomish County, the U.S. Small Business Administration has set up a disaster loan outreach center. Mary Ann Bradfield is with the federal agency. She says they're trying to make it easy for people hit by last year's flooding to apply for aid that can go towards home repairs and replacing personal items.
Furniture, clothes, your automobile, little things that you don't think about that you need.
Homeowners can potentially access hundreds of thousands of dollars with these loans. Bradfield says this can help people avoid credit card debt and give them time to figure out what's next.
We also have 12 months without interest or payments required to give everybody a chance to get back on their feet.
The deadline to apply for property damage assistance is April 27th. I'm Mitch Borden, reporting.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. If you have a news tip or story idea, email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Or call us at 503-325-0010. Up next, we're taking a little break from the hard news and cracking open a book. Northern Community Radio out of Minnesota interviews the authors of a book about a diverse but disappearing ecosystem, the North American Prairie.
Former Minneapolis Star Tribune editor and journalist Dave Hagi and Josephine Marcotti are the authors of a new book that chronicles the North American Prairie. It's called Sea of Grass: The Conquest, Ruin, and Redemption of Nature on the American Prairie. In this book, they examine our relationship with this complex land and what it will take to maintain the health of it for future generations. Here's our What We're Reading conversation with David Hagi and Josephine Marcotti. So something that I think readers will get from this book is that our prairies are actually quite complex. There is this image of prairies as kind of homespun. We've got Laura Ingalls Wilder, that Midwestern mythology, versus the progress and the dark history behind occupying the land. And additionally, the effects that agriculture has had on the environment of the region.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Tammy. My mom and dad both grew up in small prairie towns of Western Minnesota. I spent summers in Western Minnesota on the edge of the prairie. I thought it was boring, just a bunch of grass, and many people do. But as Josephine and I discovered in the book, the prairie is an incredibly complex ecosystem and an incredibly rich landscape. The Western tall grass prairie, which still exists, we haven't plowed it up. There are more than 1,000 varieties of grass and flowers. There are more than 200 varieties of butterfly. There are more than 1 billion grassland birds. The soil is so complex that it's such a rich, rich living thing. If you scooped up 1 tablespoon of prairie soil in your hand, that tablespoon of prairie soil contains more microorganisms than the human population on Earth, 3 billion microorganisms. So the prairie is a rich, living, complex thing.
You know, we think of when we read books like Laurie, like Little House on the Prairie or Willa Cather or books by Willa Cather, or, you know, the history books that tell the story of the European colonialism, you know, we sort of think of the prairie as something that's still there, you know, that it's part of our history and that it's, you know, it's there if we go look for it. But for most of the Midwest, it's not. I mean, it's gone. And it's a mythological landscape in many ways, in the sense that there's only 1% left, and that 1% is scattered in tiny, tiny little plots, you know, all over the Midwest. The prairie that remains is in the West, and that's the short grass prairie for the most part, which doesn't support farming. And so that's why it still exists, is that it was never a good place to farm. And that's where ranchers are. But that's really one of the few places. I mean, there are a few places in the Midwest where you can really get a sense of what the prairie was. The Flint Hills in Kansas are among them. Glacial Ridge in northwest Minnesota is another. But really to get a sense of what the prairies were like in terms of their size and their space and their wildness, you really have to go out west.
A lot of people will see the prairie for the first time just driving across it. Maybe they're driving from Chicago to Los Angeles or something, and they just think it's boring, it's flat. But there's a little secret that prairie lovers know. If you pull over to the side of the road, if you step out of your car and wade into that tall grass, it's just a riot of color and sound. It's meadowlarks and bobolinks and prairie asters and coneflowers, yellow, purple, red. It is one of the richest sensory experiences you can have anywhere.
Great. Thank you. That really paints a picture. We can't really talk about prairies and plains without talking about agriculture. And the book, your book goes into several aspects of how agriculture works these days and its effect on the environment. And I think it's easy to say for someone who's not directly involved in farming or agriculture, well, why don't they just stop using fertilizers or try to do things sustainably when we talk about the effects that farming has on the land without quite knowing what predicament farmers are in today. And you get into that in the book. Can farmers change their practices in a meaningful way at this point to kind of turn things around with the environment?
I just say two quick things about that. It's a great question. It's a really great question. It runs right through our book. And our book is critical of modern industrial scale agriculture, but we're not down on farmers. We met a lot of wonderful farmers. They're trying to make a living. They're trying to put their kids through college, trying to keep the family farm solvent. We met farmers, Western Minnesota. They borrow $1 million every spring just to put a crop in the ground, diesel, seed, fertile, $1 million. They make one little mistake. They take one little gamble that doesn't work out. They could lose the family farm. It would be a catastrophe. And we all know in Minnesota how horrible and sad that would be. At the same time, we also found a lot of farmers who are taking those risks. A great group in Iowa called Practical Farmers of Iowa. It's a farmer-to-farmer organization to promote conservation practices. And they've demonstrated that farmers can adopt conservation farming techniques. They can reduce their use of artificial fertilizer. They can diversify their crop rotations. They can improve their soil. And they save money by doing it. So the conservation practice, by working with nature instead of working against nature, they save money and they can still succeed.
You know, I think that in order for farmers to, the vast majority of conventional farmers to change what they do, it would be really important to change federal policy on ag policy in terms of, you know, the enormous price supports that crops like corn and soybeans get compared to other crops that would allow farmers to diversify, you know, whether it's risky crops like Kernza, which is a perennial wheat, as opposed to the annual wheat that we grow, or whether it's growing vegetables or fruits, or oats or alfalfa, or raising animals, the insurance and the protections that farmers get from the federal ag bill is very lopsided toward just a handful of crops.
This is What We're Reading, and we are talking with authors David Hagi and Josephine Marcotti about their new book, Sea of Grass, The Conquest, Ruin, and Redemption of Nature on the American Prairie. So I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about prairie restoration. Josephine mentioned earlier that only 1% of prairie lands remain in existence today. While it sounds like a massive undertaking to revert land back to prairie, there are people who seem committed to doing so, and you get into that a little bit in your book. So what is that process like, and what have the results of that been?
Yeah, we talked yesterday to a group mostly based in Wisconsin and Minnesota called the Prairie Enthusiasts. And these are private landowners, people who own land and are working hard to protect and restore prairie on that land. And there's another group in Minnesota of private prairie owners who are doing the same thing. It's difficult because once you sell the land, or if you want to sell the land, then the new owner can do whatever they want. And even though the state of Minnesota works very hard to protect native prairie plots or native prairie that's left, we are still losing native prairie at a slow rate, but we're still losing native prairie, which is a terrible thing because we lose so much evolution and biodiversity. when those native plots are plowed up or turned into suburbs. So I think, again, that conservation is up against a real sort of cultural divide in the sense of we disagree a lot on what land is for. There are people who believe that land is and should remain, you know, can be, you know, remain in a natural state. But there are so many other people, particularly in rural areas, who depend on agriculture for their economy. They think land is there to make money. Land is there to be farmed. And the more farmland you have, the better your, you know, the healthier your population, the healthier your economy.
Did any kind of happy medium or middle ground kind of come to you as you wrote this book regarding that paradox?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think the key thing is to find land that, you know, everybody treasures, you know, a beautiful place. To find land that's really not good for farming. You know, either it's, you know, it's too dry, it's too wet, you know, it's on a river bottom. And then to find a way to make the owners of that land accept, you know, a price for it that is, you know, is reasonable. And then persuade the community, much like they did in Glacial Ridge, to work with the community to help them understand what the advantages are and what the risks are for that land and farming. I mean, it's hard work. I mean, but the hard work is the people, not the land.
On the large scale out in Montana, there's a magnificent project called American Prairie Reserve. They call themselves American Prairie now. They're right in the middle of Montana along the Missouri River. It's private philanthropists who raise millions and millions of dollars. They started buying up cattle ranches that were going out of business. They now have 600,000 acres of restored short grass prairie. It's a magnificent place. Bison, wolves, grizzlies, prairie dogs, the whole thing. But they, as Josephine said, they really had to navigate a lot of local politics. Local ranchers were suspicious. They thought it was a public government federal land grab. They thought it was a bunch of smart aleck big city environmentalists telling them what to do with their land. Things are getting better now. For example, they will let neighboring ranchers graze their cattle on American Prairie Reserve. They found different ways to cooperate with the community. And as Josephine writes in our chapter on Glacial Ridge in northwestern Minnesota, they did the same thing there. They found ways to cooperate with the local counties so they weren't losing revenue, so they got a supply of clean water. But the politics are really tough.
Yeah, one of the recent sad things about American Prairie is that they had permits to graze bison, the wild bison, on federal land, the BLM land that's out there.